Blog Talk Radio.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's Empowerment Network. It's 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment just for you. It's your man Marvin Rome, coming to you for part 5 of our community conversation. What slavery did to us. Oh yeah. Let's get started. We're here today with Brother George for another conversation, a candid conversation, talking about what slavery did to us. We're going to talk about Willie Lynch and that impact. We're going to talk about the Great Migration, and then we're going to talk about the Harlem Renaissance. But as always, first is the Empowerment Pledge, and that pledge is I will work on myself. And if you would dedicate and commit yourself to just doing the work of working on yourself, mentally, physically, emotional, spiritual, cultural, financial, or anything that you know you need to do to emancipate yourself, to heal yourself from the trauma of the experience of living in this society, then you have a leg up on most people. So the work of the NAAEA is to create programs that ensure that the needs of the African-American community are met. And we have to do that. We have to develop programs and services that educate, inspire, motivate, and our people to become empowered, to become the best people that we can be. And it's shows like this, right? We're talking about our history and educating us on what we need to do. And those five pillars of empowerment: politics, economics, athletics, health, wellness, fitness, culture, and education. Those things really matter. And the more that we focus on developing ourselves, developing our communities, educating ourselves on our history and our rich culture, and then deciding that if we put it all together and get a great economic plan and become politically active, we can change things just right where we are each day, every day, one day at a time. So I invite you to sit back, tell your friends, right? Play this thing back, right? Let your friends and family know that the empowerment exists for African Americans and that we're going to continue to spread the good word of empowerment and motivation. So now we'll move on to our best part of the show and bringing in Brother George. Brother George, are you available?
Yes, sir, I am. And I appreciate, you know, another invitation to come in and speak to the people. We started with Willie Lynch, and well, first of all, I wanted to say we're in part 5, and if you notice, we've been emancipated and we're out of the slave experience physically, but we're still mentally attached to the slave-making experience, and so that's why the program is still called What Slavery Did to Us. Now, I wanted to go back to Willie Lynch. And Willie Lynch actually took place in 1712. And I've done some little more research on Willie Lynch and got a viewpoint of a brother that wrote a book on Willie Lynch. And he says some interesting things in his book. So today I'm going to take the time to do some quotes out of his book because I thought that he really had a very, you know, interesting analogy to what Willie Lynch meant. Now, I'm going to start out in his foreword. He says, as we research history for the purpose of our book, Slavery, the African-American Psychic Trauma, we discovered that detailed records of our African ancestry, of our African ancestors, had been carefully preserved and hidden away in institutions controlled by whites. The Africans who were brought to America and forced into slavery were writers, educators, builders, agricultural experts, religious leaders, and soldiers. This was the story that had never been told in American history books. It is certainly not taught in American schools. We discovered that many of our African ancestors wrote manuscripts while on the plantation, describing their homes, their families, their culture, and their lives, prior to capture and enslavement by whites. Their writing was often in Arabic, the common language used in many African schools and universities at the time. However, their African-born children were told the lie that their parents had been ignorant, naked, savage people who were fortunate enough to be brought to America by whites to be civilized. These children, having no access to their foreparents' language or writings, believed the lie, and therefore had no memories of previous independence to help them overcome the effects of slavery. In their own eyes, they were a people of little value. Now, that was interesting, but I'm going to go on and continue to read some passages out of this book, because they connect up with what the Willie Lynch speech was really all about. The system introduced by Willie Lynch was designed to keep African Americans from ever again forming the strong family groups that led to the creation of the Ghanaian Empire. It was designed to keep them so petty, childish, selfish, and jealous of each other that they could never join forces for mutual advancement. Now, the Willie Lynch speech, like I said, was done in 1712, and the purpose of it was to make slavery a science. And once they turned slavery into a science and did this Willie Lynch thing on us, it has really carried over to today. And so some of the ways to deactivate your Willie Lynchship, to borrow a phrase from Dr. Ray Higgins, is to just flood your children with our history, with our accomplishments, with our inventions. Just flood their minds with positive self-images. Now, I'm going to move to another part of the Willie Lynch. Now, there was something interesting about what Willie Lynch taught. After he went through his presentation, he gave some things that for the slave master to be careful of. And that's why I know that the solution is for us to flood our children with positive black self-images. Our experts warned us about the possibility of this phenomenon occurring, for they say that the mind has a strong drive to correct and recorrect itself over a period of time if it can touch some substantial original historical base. And they advised us that the best way to deal with this phenomenon is to shave off the brute's mental history and create a multiplicity of phenomena of illusions, so that each illusion will twirl in its own orbit, something similar to floating balls in a vacuum. Now, what they were talking about is why they kept us from reading. Because once we got exposed, or even would teach us to read, because once we got exposed to some of the books that our ancestors might have possibly written, the human mind has a way of knowing what belongs to it. And so that would be one of those things that would help to adjust and readjust the mind to get back to its original functioning as a scientific mind. Now, I have another quote that's within the brother's book, and I think that all of these are very important. The key to success is creating independent and focused leadership for education. These leaders would put constant pressure on principals, parents, and public school boards. Children are born brilliant, but the public schools do not do a remarkable job of mentally beating the brilliance out of the African-American children. Every African-American child has a unique talent. Every child is born with the potential to do something great. It is the responsibility of all African-Americans to develop an educational system to bring out and develop those skills. Now, that's on us as African-American adults. It's up to us to deal with things relating to our children.
Wow, you said a mouthful, brother. So what I hear you saying is that we must deactivate this Willie Lynch chip, and education is the key. And you mentioned flooding our children with information about ourselves. How many of us are really approaching this education thing properly? And so if you look at the peace concept, it's politics, economics, athletics, wellness, health, fitness, nutrition, culture, and the last vital piece is education. This is part of this process. We have to re-educate our people in order to perform. Our kids have to be prepared to compete, but also to know who they are, to know themselves, and to understand what that means. So that means that leadership is going to be important, and developing leadership is also quintessential to success in our community. It is people like Brother George helping us to reach our potential by educating us, and that we need a system of educating our people on how to educate our people. So, Brother George, tell us a little bit more that you have on Willie Lynch.
Well, basically, I'm beginning to understand that Willie Lynch was the key ingredient that's holding us back. I mean, we still deal with each other in childish, selfish, you know, ways that we don't want to see one another get ahead. We don't trust ourselves. We don't trust each other, you know, and when you don't trust each other, that means that collectively it's very difficult for us to do anything, to accomplish things, because there's a lack of trust there. And so if we decide, well, we want to start a school, then you'll hear a hundred different reasons why that's going to be so difficult and this, that, and the other. And it's because we don't trust ourselves, and so we don't trust that we have a good enough mind to really educate our own children, to really put together a accurate school system that can effectively train our people and have our people competing in the overall culture and the larger world. You know, it's something that I know for certain that we can do. And we need to break away from that Willie Lynch mindset. We need to do everything we can to try to do as much together and believe in each other, even when you don't want to believe in each other. Just believe in each other. You know, allow a small failure to take place before you don't believe in your brother or your sister. Try to do whatever you can. And whatever you can, flood your children's minds with positive self-images.
Wow, so that goes back to that conditioning, right? So we have to recondition or uncondition our people. And the public school system is a part of this social service system in many of our communities. So we got the school system giving out food to family and children. We have to be able to provide that for ourselves, and our parents have to get to a place where we're taking the lead on what happens in our community. And so we can't keep looking for a handout. We have to educate ourselves, and we have to improve our communities by doing the work of working on ourselves, and that's mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, and financially. If we can master those pieces, I think we'll have it. What else you got, brother?
I wanted to move on from Willie Lynch and talk briefly about the Great Migration. Now, that's what that is just picking up from part four. In part four, we left off with Plessy versus Ferguson, which was a case that helped to entrench segregation and Jim Crow laws to exist until 1954. And so what happened was the Great Migration was actually the end result of the Plessy versus Ferguson win for segregationists, because once they put all those laws into effect, our people were very negatively affected. And after a while of experiencing lynching and experiencing so much discrimination, hard to find a job, hard to live, you know, decent without being in fear, the Klan burning down your homes and all of that, it pushed us to make a decision to move away from the South. And so what we did was we migrated to different portions of the country. The Great Migration was the relocation of more than 6 million African Americans from the rural South to the cities of the North, Midwest, and West from about 1916 to 1970. Now, the Great Migration was started long before that. Driven from their homes by unsatisfactory economic opportunities and harsh segregationist laws, many blacks headed north, whether they took advantage of the need to industrial workers that arose during the First World War. Now, what happened was, at that time, they weren't letting us go into the military. So there were a whole lot of us who were unemployed, and all of the whites were going to war. The white young men were going to war. And so that left the factories short of labor. And so we immediately came in and filled that labor void. Now, another thing that the Great Migration did was the Great Migration sent a large number of us into the one city in particular, which was in New York City, and to Harlem in particular. And in the decades between 1910 and 1920, the black population of major northern cities grew by large percentages, including 66% in New York, Chicago 148%, Philadelphia 500%, and Detroit 611%. In other words, we were moving, you know, quickly, you know, up north. And after the United States Supreme Court declared housing ordinances unconstitutional in 1917, because what they were doing was they wouldn't rent to us. And so once we got up there amongst the whites up north, which the whites up north really were not a lot better than the whites in the South. They just didn't have the Jim Crow laws where white bathroom here, black bathroom here. They just didn't have it spelt out like that. But as far as their attitudes towards us, it was very similar. And so the Supreme Court had a ruling on the fact that they could not legally not rent to someone because of their racial makeup. And so at that point, you know, we were able to rent from whites. But I mean, it's not to say that it was really a good thing, because they were still in control of it and boosted up the prices and different things like that. So, you know, so that took place. But now, one of the interesting things that happened was that you had a movement, and it was like a cultural movement, because a large portion of the black population moved into the place which you call Harlem. And it was like 200,000 African Americans that moved into Harlem. Now, that was an eventuality, because in the beginning, Harlem was all white. It was an all white middle class place. And so once a few, what they did was they started overdeveloping. And sometimes when you overdevelop, you wind up with a lot of vacant lots. And so something needed to be put in place of those vacant lots that they had. So they eventually put apartment houses and different things, and they needed somebody to rent them. So our people started renting those places. Now, you know what happens when blacks move in. You know, when the blacks move in, then whites try to, they'll try to do a lot of scare tactics with you in the first, in the beginning, and then eventually they're going to start moving out. So when they started moving out in numbers, blacks started moving in numbers. And so that, so you ended up with more than 200,000 African Americans moving into Harlem, and that's how Harlem became, you know, Black Harlem.
Okay, so this great movement of 6 million African Americans into the North, New York and Detroit, Chicago and Philadelphia, and if you look at the condition of those cities now in most highly populated, dense communities with African Americans, there's a lot of poverty. There is a lot of murders, right? And if you look at just what happened in the last few weeks in these cities, there is a lot of crime in terms of violence in our communities. And we have to be able to do a better job of managing ourselves as well. We are going to really look at the Harlem Renaissance, right? So we're going to examine that right now. So Brother George, tell us a little bit about the Harlem Renaissance and what happened in that time period.
Now, when I was researching this, because I had done a paper on the Harlem Renaissance when I was in college, and what I realized was that the impact of the Great Migration, it placed a lot of black people concentrated in one area, which gave us a certain amount of political power. And so Harlem was the greatest example. We were in numbers in a lot of different places, and so we began to get more political. Now, the Harlem Renaissance was the development of a Harlem neighborhood in New York as a black cultural mecca in the early 20th century. And the subsequent social and artistic explosion that resulted, lasting roughly from 1910s through the mid-1930s. The period is considered the golden age of African-American culture, manifesting in literature, music, stage performances, and arts. Now, the Harlem Renaissance was one of the greatest arts and of the arts, because music and art are both considered arts. It was one of the greatest periods in the history of the world, really, the Harlem Renaissance. And to tie in the Great Migration with the Harlem Renaissance, the Northern Manhattan neighborhood of Harlem was meant to be an upper-class white neighborhood in the 1880s. But rapid overdevelopment led to the empty buildings and desperate landlords seeking to fill them. In the early 1900s, a few middle-class black families from another neighborhood known as Black Bohemia moved to Harlem, and other black families followed. Some white residents initially fought to keep African Americans out of the area, but failing, that many whites eventually fled. Now, when you talk about the Harlem Renaissance itself, it was a movement, and the Harlem Renaissance was a political movement as well. But I'm going to talk about the political aspects in part six, because it's such a wealth of talent and contributions to the artistic part that I would rather start there first, and then we'll do the political part in part six.
Okay, great. So we're looking at the political power that community cohesion has in terms of getting together, right? And so with this impact of our community coming together in terms of the arts, and think about the impact of what we can do when we become really sound in developing ourselves, right? We have to be able to get to a place where we are using our knowledge base and our information to develop our people. And this is a great way to do it. So all we have to do is look at what's already happened and pattern ourselves after our great ancestors who led the way. So we'll transition right now into talking about some of those heroes and heroines during that time. And we'll start with Langston Hughes.
Yeah, that's a great choice, you know, to start with. You know, Langston Hughes was an African-American writer whose poems, columns, novels, and plays made him a leading figure in the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. James Mercer Langston Hughes was born on February 1st, 1902, in Joplin, Missouri. His parents, James Hughes and Carrie Langston, separated soon after his birth, and his father moved to Mexico. While Hughes' mother moved around during his youth, Hughes was raised primarily by his maternal grandmother, Mary. Eventually, when his grandmother passed, he moved back with his mother, and they settled in Cleveland. Now, Langston Hughes was really a big figure in the Harlem Renaissance. He was his writings, his poems, you know, the books that he wrote. I mean, he was huge. And during the time Hughes first began writing poetry, and one of his teachers introduced him to Carrie Sanders and Walt Whitman. Both of whom, Walt Whitman, both of whom, Hughes would later cite as primary influences. And then he started writing, you know, for the magazine at school and at college. And so, you know, by him being African American, they would reject his work, you know. So he eventually had to, you know, go for his own self. Now, Hughes graduated from high school in 1920 and spent the following year with his father. Around this time, Hughes' poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, and these were like classic poems and different things that Hughes was done, was published in the Crisis magazine, which was a black magazine, and was praised. Hughes dropped out. He eventually went to Columbia University, and he didn't stay there long. I don't know if it was because it was a European school and he didn't feel like he fit, they didn't want to listen to his stuff, whatever, but he dropped out of Columbia University, and then he did some odd jobs around in New York before signing as a steward on a freighter that ended up taking him to Africa and Spain. The freighter is like it's a ship that you're on, like a, might be Merchant Marines that was on there, you know, and he worked there, and he left the ship in 1924, and he briefly spent some time in Paris. And I noticed that a lot of our artists of this time went over into Europe, and they would live there for years, you know. And but eventually, in 1925, Hughes wrote a poem, The Weary Blues, and won him first prize in the Opportunity Magazine literary competition. And he won a scholarship to attend Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. Now, Lincoln is a HBCU that's in Pennsylvania to this day. And he studied, Hughes studied poetry and came to the attention of novelist and critic Carl Vern Vecten, who used his connections to help Hughes' first book of poetry be published. The Weary Blues, published by Knopf in 1926, the book was popular, had popular appeal and established both his poetic style and his commitment to Black themes and heritage. In other words, people that were in the Harlem Renaissance, they were writing about our culture from our perspective, and that's what made them so significant. But I also think that that's what set up a lot of blocks in their way. Now, one of Hughes's significant works was in July of 1936. He published one of his most celebrated poems, "Let America Be America Again," in essence, in Esquire magazine, which examined the unrealized hopes and dreams of the country's lower class and disadvantaged, expressing a sense of hope that the American dream would one day arrive for Black folks. And so that was really a significant poem that he wrote during that time. Now, one of Hughes's most popular characters that he created a character named Jesse B. Simple. And Simple was, and his the nickname ended up being Simple instead of Jesse B. Simple. And so Simple was a Black man, you know, everyday Black man that Hughes used to further, you know, exemplify what the average Black goes through within the community and society being a Black man. And that's what he wrote about with Jesse B. Simple. And then another one of his significant poems was A Dream Deferred, you know, and A Dream Deferred was like another one of those poems that depicted, you know, how, you know, we have aspirations and we have dreams to become certain things, and being African Americans, it's just deferred. Now, Langston Hughes passed away in 1967. He passed away in 1967, and you know, he left a tremendous legacy. He died of prostate cancer, and he left a tremendous legacy, and that's Langston Hughes.
Wow, a literary genius. So don't let the dream be deferred any longer. Who will be our next literary giant, right? Who will stand in the gap? Let's begin again to impact our community by giving our people stuff that will stimulate them mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Let's talk about Josephine Baker.
Yes, sir. Josephine has always been one of my favorites because she has a certain charisma about herself that it was just amazing to me, you know, how she defined the world, you know. But Josephine Baker was a dancer and singer who became wildly popular in France during the 1920s. She also devoted much of her time to fighting racism. Now, Josephine Baker, she spans through more than one decade. So I might speak of her again when it comes to the civil rights movement, because she played an active role in that also. But Josephine spent her youth in poverty, and a lot of our, you know, entertainers were impoverished. In the 1920s, she moved to France and soon became one of Europe's most popular and highest paid performers. She also worked in the with the French resistance during World War II because she had married a Frenchman at the time. After beginning her comeback to the stage in 1973, she died of cerebral hemorrhage on April the 12th of 1975, as she was built, but she was buried with a military funeral. Now, Josephine was born, actually, Frieda Josephine McDonald, on July 3rd, 1906, in St. Louis, Missouri. Her mother, Carrie McDonald, was a washerwoman who had given up her dreams to become a music hall dancer, and her father was a drummer, and he abandoned Josephine and her mother shortly after her birth. And so her mother remarried, and she had a number of sisters and brothers by her stepfather. Now, with Josephine, she felt that she was treated poorly, you know, at home. And so she briefly returned to school for 2 years, and then later she ran away at the age of 13. And finding work as a waitress at a club while working through, she married one of the guys that she met there, and they divorced like a couple of weeks after that. And Josephine Baker is another one, you know, that she had a great deal of marriages, and all of them were failed marriages, but she married maybe three or four times. And she's not like the only one that experienced that. A lot of these artists married three and four times, you know, and I don't know if it was because their marriages were just failed marriages. I think that they were like more family oriented, and so they didn't think of the idea of being girlfriend and boyfriend is the way that it's more popularized today. And so she married and she divorced in a few years later. In 1923, she landed a role in a musical called Shuffle. And when she landed that role, she moved to New York, and she was performing in the Chocolate Candies, which is like a group. And so eventually she traveled to France. She traveled overseas because she was being treated, you know, she wasn't being welcomed well. And Josephine was a sensitive type of person. And so when the white audiences, you know, gave her problems, she didn't really want to perform in front of them. So she went to France, and she did a performance called the La Revue Nigre. Now, that's in French, so if I didn't say it right, pardon me. She made an immediate impression on French audiences with dance partner Joe Alex. She performed the Dancy Savage, in which she wore only a skirt, only a feathered skirt, because Josephine Baker used to dance like with fruits around her and just bird feathers and things like that. And so eventually she went to the banana skirt. And when she wore that banana skirt and she performed in it, it just was like overwhelming to the audiences. And eventually that's how she became being paid so highly, because those Europeans wanted to see her dance, and that, you know, do the dances that she did, the cultural dances, and she was able to make a huge amount of money. Now, Josephine did try to make a comeback to the United States and come and perform in the United States after she had so much success in France. But she got back to the United States, and they started, you know, the audiences started mistreating her. They weren't reacting to her the same way as in France. And so she left and she went back to France. And as I said, you know, Josephine was a, in 1947, she married an orchestra leader, and in the beginning of 1950, began to adopt babies. Now, Josephine was also known for adopting kids from all different countries all around the world. So she had maybe about 20 kids or something like that, and they were of different ethnic backgrounds. And so, you know, but she was so into, you know, people that she was very real and she was very touched with experiencing different people's culture and different children, and she raised those children well. She didn't abuse them or anything to that effect. Now, the other part of her life is going to begin to go into politics. And so I'm going to leave off there with Josephine, and I'll probably pick her back up when we get to the civil rights struggle.
Okay, Josephine Baker, another one of our charismatic performers, limited by the system and the culture of this country at that time. Just imagine what could have happened if they were allowed to flourish here. And so Europe actually played a critical role in the development of the skills of our professionals and offered opportunities for them to flourish and grow. Let's talk about the life of County Cullen. What do you have, brother?
Now, County Cullen was another one of those that was just like Langston Hughes that had a huge impact on the Harlem Renaissance period itself. He was one of those that, you know, you take him out of the Harlem Renaissance and you're taking a big piece out. Writer County Cullen was an iconic figure of the Harlem Renaissance, known for his poetry, fiction, and plays. County Cullen was born on May 30th, 1903, and was recognized as an award-winning poet by his high school years. He published his acclaimed debut volume of poetry, Color, in 1925, which would be furthered by Copper Sun and The Ballad of the Brown Girl. Also a noted novelist, playwright, and children's author, Cullen later worked as a high school teacher. He died January 9th, 1945. Now, County Cullen was another one that, he's not really another one. He's because I haven't spoken of them yet, but Cullen was born in 1903, but exactly where he was born is not certain. It says that he could have been born in Louisville, Kentucky, or Baltimore, or New York City. Having lost his parents and brother, it is believed that he was raised by his paternal grandmother until her death during his teen years. He was then adopted by a reverend named Frederick A. Cullen, which I assume that's where he got his last name from, a conservative minister of renown, and he was the reverend over a Methodist Episcopal church in Harlem. As an award-winning poet from 1918 to 1921, Cullen attended DeWitt Clinton High School, where he edited the school newspaper and literary magazine and won citywide poetry competition. He went on to attend New York University, where he graduated Phi Beta Kappa in 1925. Now, I don't know if Phi Beta Kappa was a fraternity at the time, But I thought that's what Phi Beta Kappa was, but maybe that's, you know, something like summa cum laude. But at any rate, he won the Witter Bryant Poetry Prize that same year. Cullen released his launch debut poet, Color, which Color was one of his significant works. And so that springboarded his career. He graduated with a master's from Harvard University in 1926, subsequently joined the editorial staff of Opportunity magazine, pending a column called Dark Tower, which was a review of works from the African American Literary Society. Now, Cullen eventually he married the daughter of W.B. Du Bois, which you know, many of y'all know, and I'll talk about him during the political part of the Harlem Renaissance. Yet the marriage was short-lived, and they were divorced by 1930. Now, County Cullen, he was he died on January the 9th, 1946, like I said, and he died from uremia and complications from high blood pressure, which a lot of our people experience high blood pressure and have problems with it. And he was survived by his then wife, Ida Mae Robertson. And a collection of Cullen's poetry was published in 1947 on These I Stand, an anthology of the best terms of the best poems of County Cullen. His legacy also includes public schools named after the poet, as well as Harlem's 135th Street Branch Library. After a period of dormancy, more attention has been paid to the scholarship of Cullen's life and writings, and in 2012, a biography of Cullen was written. And that's County Cullen.
Wow. Impactful writer, poet, and master's degree in 1926. County Cullen, we need to see how we can apply ourselves and continue to walk in the footsteps of these giants. So tell us a little bit, brother, about Zora Neale Hurston and what she did.
Now, Zora Neale Hurston, you know, she was really, really interesting because, you know, her credentials are she was a writer and anthropologist. Zora Neale Hurston was a fixture of the Harlem Renaissance and author of the masterwork, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Now, Zora Neale Hurston became a fixture of the Harlem Renaissance due to her novels like Their Eyes Were Watching God and short works like Sweat. She was also an outstanding folklorist and anthropologist who recorded cultural history. Now, she also did a work with Langston Hughes called Mules and Men. And she died, Hurston died in poverty in 1960. Now, that's a shame because a lot of our artists also, they died in poverty. And that continues to happen today. But what I want to talk about Hurston was, you know, the fact that she was an anthropologist means that she studied, when she was writing, she also was studying different groups of people. And she studied us very intensely also. So, and what she did was, she was born in She was born in Alabama, okay, but she only remembers being in Florida, where her family moved right after she was born. But what she did was, she eventually, when she left Harlem for a while, she went back to Florida, and what she did was she started studying a lot of the folklore that was in the South and stuff that came directly from Africa and still had an African scent to it, you know. And so she would write about these different things. And when she wrote her great work, Their Eyes Were Watching God, I believe that was when she was visiting Haiti, and she had won some type of scholarship, and she went to Haiti. And when she went to Haiti, she wrote that, and when she traveled to Haiti, she wrote what would become, you know, her most famous work, which was Their Eyes Were Watching God. And she had some controversies in her life where she had some backlash from her opinions about the Brown versus Board of Education situation, but that goes into politics, and, you know, I'll address that later, but it's probably because she must have felt like we would do better being segregated, because we were getting a better education and to force our children into integration, you know. But that's for another time. And, you know, and that's Zora Neale Hurston.
Wow. Thank you, brother. The African-American experience is very powerful, and sharing it can change lives and minds. We're talking about poverty, talking about politics and success. And so as we continue to go through, there seems to be a pattern that's unfolding about what's happening to some of our greats in terms of the experience that they have, and somewhat resisting the system in those days, but also finding themselves in positions of finding success. So there's a unique space that our greats are finding themselves in. Let's talk a little bit about the life of Duke Ellington.
Well, there you go. Now, Duke Ellington was probably the most well-noted of the Harlem Renaissance era. Now, he was a jazz musician. He wasn't a writer. So, an originator of the big band jazz, Duke Ellington was an American composer, pianist, and band leader who composed thousands of scores over his 50-year career. Now, he had a 50-year career in music. And Duke, he wasn't born poor. Duke was born into a middle-class black family. His mother and his father were very talented, and they both, were educated. And he was raised in Washington, D.C., and he earned the nickname Duke for his gentlemanly-like ways, because he was a pianist as a very young man, as a very young boy. And so he carried himself, you know, very gentlemanly, and so they started nicknaming him the Duke. Now, Duke Ellington was another one that played a lot of the different Broadway nightclubs, and he was just by far one of the biggest names in jazz at that time, if not the biggest name in jazz at that time. And he did get married. He married his high school sweetheart, and soon after, you know, they had their first child, and you know, his name was Mercer Kennedy Ellington. Now, Ellington also had a sense for musical drama that made him stand out. His blend of melodies, rhythms, and subtle movements gave audiences a new experience. In other words, the way that he just played his music, you know, was mesmerizing to people. And one of the things that he used to do to make up his big bands is he would try to get people that had unique sounds with their instrument. You know how they had that wah-wah sound and the Scooby-Doo, all that kind of, he liked to get people in his big band that had unique sounds. And so he could create unique sounds when he would put together one of his scores. Now, Duke, in May 24th, 1974, Duke passed away, and he died from lung cancer and pneumonia. And his last words were, "Music is why I live, how I live. Music is my life. How I live, why I live, and how I will be remembered." More than 12,000 people attended Duke's funeral, and he was buried in Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx, New York.
The Duke Ellington, musician, composer, band leader. This man spent 50 years in music. That's a life. That's a legacy. Let's go really quickly to Oscar Michaud and then Bill Bojangles Robinson.
Now, Oscar Michaud was the only one that was into movie making. Now, I'm going to... Oscar Michaud was an African-American author, filmmaker, an independent film producer. He made 44 films, and although his, you know, the Lincoln Motion Picture Company was short-lived, it was the only one that was owned and controlled by black filmmakers. Michaud is the first major African-American film producer, and he was another big figure in the Harlem Renaissance era. They called him the Czar of Black Hollywood. Now, I'm going to move to Bill Bojangles Robinson because he should be familiar because he's a Richmond native. Bill Bojangles was an iconic African-American tap dancer and actor best known for his Broadway performances and film roles. Bill Bojangles Robinson started his career as a vaudeville performer, transitioning to Broadway and to Hollywood films in the 1930s and 1940s. His delicate tap dance style and cheerful demeanor made Robinson a favorite of both black and white audiences. He died in New York City on November of 1925. Bill Bojangles Robinson.
Wow, two of our greats. Think about Oscar Michaud and having a motion picture company and a film producer. Incredible. And then Richmond's great, our native son and brother, Bill Bojangles Robinson, and what he did in terms of his life and legacy in Hollywood and what he did as a performer. This is our history, people. This is what we do. It's part five of What Slavery Did to Us. Join us on Saturdays for Empowerment Saturday. It's an opportunity for you to share your voice and to speak in a place where there is complete openness and a safe space for us to talk and dialogue. Also, join us on the web at www.theempowerment.weebly.com. The NAAEA is moving forward. Thank you, Brother George, for another wonderful conversation, educating us on our people and our history and our culture. Take the opportunity to try to advance yourself, your children, your family, any way that we can continue to educate ourselves, learn about our history and our culture, and becoming the best person that you can be today and every day. We'll talk to you soon once again. It is our Community Conversations with Brother George. Peace.
in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.